Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The definitive account of Bill Cosby's transition from revered father figure to convicted criminal. Bill Cosby's decades-long career as a sweater-wearing, wholesome TV dad came to a swift and stunning end on April 26, 2018, when he was convicted of drugging and sexually assaulting Andrea Constand. The mounting allegations against Bill Cosby, more than 60 women have come forward to accuse him of similar crimes, and his ultimate conviction were a shock to Americans, who wanted to cleave to their image of Cosby as a pudding pop hero. Award-winning journalist and former People magazine senior writer Nikki Wisenzi Egan was the first reporter to dig into the story when Constant went to police in 2005. Other news organizations looked away, but Egan doggedly investigated the case, developing ties with entrenched sources and discovering incriminating details that would ultimately come to influence the prosecution. In her debut book, Chasing Cosby, Egan shares her firsthand account of Cosby's 13-year run from justice. She tells us how Cosby planned and executed his crimes, and how Hollywood alliances and law enforcement knew what Cosby was doing but did nothing to stop him. A veteran crime reporter, Egan also explores the cultural and social issues that influenced the case, delving into the psychological calculations of a serial predator and into the psyche of a nation that fervently wanted to put their faith in the innocence of America's dad. Rich in character and rife with dramatic revelations about popular culture, media power, and our criminal system, Egan's account will inform and fascinate readers with its candid telling of humanity's most enduring tale, the rise and fall of a cultural icon. The book that we're featuring this evening is Chasing Cosby, The Downfall of America's Dad, with my special guest journalist and author, Nicole Wisenzi Egan. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Nicole Wisenzi Egan.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. Incredible, timely story, and even though this story is not about murder, the audience will certainly appreciate this. Let's talk about, as you write in the book, January 13, 2005. Tell us about Andrea Constand and how you opened the book about her experience with Bill Cosby. Tell us about January 13, 2005 and that story.
Sure. That morning, she woke up from yet another nightmare, and she was sobbing. It was a nightmare where she dreamed that she was seeing a woman getting sexually assaulted because she hadn't come forward about what had happened to her. She had been having it over the last year and had woken up screaming sometimes from her sleep. Her parents could hear her from their bedroom. So this morning when it happened, she just woke up and she called her mom. Her mom was on her way to work. And she called her and she blurted out, "I have PTSD, Mom. I think I have PTSD." And then Bill Cosby drugged and raped me. And it was just a shock. Like, her mother knew something was wrong with her daughter. She had come home. She had quit her job in Philadelphia and come home to enroll in massage school to be a masseuse like her father. But she wasn't herself when she came home that previous April. She was withdrawn. She lost weight. She didn't want to spend time with her family. She seemed depressed, and she was having these nightmares. So her mother, you know, later that day when her mother got home from work, they called police and reported the crime, and that set off this whole tidal wave of events that led to ultimately his conviction.
You talk about them calling, the family calling police, but they were living in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and they called them the Durham Regional Police Department at that time. Tell us what else she did other than call the police. Who else did she also call?
Well, she, because, yes, she was Canadian, she wasn't familiar with how the criminal justice system worked in the U.S., and her brother-in-law is a cop in Canada, and he had told her, you should look around for a lawyer to represent you. She didn't know if she would need a lawyer to actually file charges. I mean, she just really didn't know how the system worked. So she started calling around in the meantime to get recommendations for lawyers in the Philadelphia area, and then but didn't actually speak to them, anyone, before they called the police. And then her mother also was so worried about when she found out that her daughter had been drugged, she wanted to know what Bill Cosby had given her daughter because of the way her daughter's behavior had changed. She was worried that there was some lasting impact that was part of the reason that her daughter had been herself. So she asked Andrea for the phone number to call him, and Andrea had a number for his answering service. It's the one she always used. And her mother, you know, she was scared. Like, they were both scared in a way because they were scared. Bill Cosby's one of the most powerful people in this country in the entertainment world, and they were both nervous and scared about confronting him. But Andrea's mother's was overcome by her fear for her daughter. She had to know what he had given her daughter. So she called. That was a Thursday, but Cosby didn't end up calling her back until that Sunday. And in the meantime, they went to police. But because it happened outside the Philadelphia area and not in Toronto, the Durham police referred it to Philly erroneously at first. And then a few days later, it went to the correct police in Cheltenham Township, Pennsylvania, which is just outside Philly, which is where Cosby owns a home.
Now, you talk about a police source tipped off Harvey Hairston, an investigative reporter for Philadelphia's Channel 10, the NBC affiliate. And the allegations you write broke in Channel 10's 5 p.m. newscast on January 20th, 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what you learned and how you learned that information, and what was your capacity? Where were you working at that time, and in what capacity?
Sure. I was working at the Philadelphia Daily News at the time. I was a crime investigative writer, and I had spent the last 2 years digging into sexual misconduct among the Pennsylvania State Police. I always did investigative stories while also working the crime beat. So that's why it was assigned to me. My boss had always said, if you want to get ahead on a story, give it to Vicki. So they gave it to me, and it was a shock because I was a fan of Cosby. I, you know, grew up watching Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids on Saturday mornings with my brother. I loved the Cosby Show. I truly thought Bill Cosby was Cliff Huxtable. So my initial reaction was not the cause. I just, you know, it wasn't something I wanted to believe either, but I had to put my personal feelings aside and just look into this and see, you know, what this was all about. And, of course, the biggest question, because we knew who Cosby was or who we thought he was who was this woman? Because her name wasn't being released. All I knew was she had worked at Temple University, and Cosby was on the board of trustees there as well and had not graduated but been given an honorary degree. So I had some sources at Temple who ended up telling me who she was, though we didn't use her name until we had permission to use it a month or so later. And her reputation was fantastic there. She was director of operations for the women's basketball team. Dawn Staley had recruited her for that job. She was the coach, and Dawn Staley was also very close with Cosby. She was one of the top five, and then I did a clip search on her name to see what else I could find out about her. And she was one of the top five women's basketball players in Canada. She was recruited by 50 to 60 colleges in the United States to play for them because she was so good, and she eventually chose the University of Arizona. She dreamed of playing for the WNBA one day, and after college she went and played in Europe for a while, and then she finally came back to Canada, and she started realizing her dreams of playing in the WNBA weren't going to happen. I mean, she used her own money to go to tryouts in various cities as well. So that's when Dawn Staley came to her and recruited her for this position at Temple. And it was a way for her to still be in the basketball world. So that's why she took that job. And that's how she met Cosby. About a year into the job, he was at a Temple women's basketball game. He was a big supporter of the team. He used to make commercials for Comcast about the team, and he would show up at games. And a donor who was at the game introduced Cosby to Andrea. And then the next day or a couple days later, he started calling her about Temple business, but he was the one who pursued this, what she viewed as a mentorship, although he would later say in his deposition in her case that he had his eye on her romantically from day one, from the moment he met her. She thought he was just a grandfather figure. I mean, he was just her mentor. He was like 10 years older than her own father. And so, you know, he's calling her, asking her questions about the team. They become friendly, and, you know, he pursued this relationship. It was not her, and she certainly wasn't in a position to say no because he was, you know, on the board of trustees at her employer. He was close with her boss, and she really, you know, had no problem with that. So that's what happened, and that's what was their relationship for the next 14 months.
You write that's interesting, too, that what you find out later is interesting in this mix, that actually Andrea is gay and not heterosexual.
Yeah, I was working on a profile of her to run when I worked on it in between, you know, the stories that were breaking on this, because in the midst of this, I got an exclusive with a second accuser who came forward, Tamara Green. So, yes, as I was interviewing former teammates and so forth, I discovered that. They said, you know that, don't you? And I said, no, actually, I didn't. So I called one of her attorneys, and I said, what do you, you know, is this true? And, you know, off the record, and they're, and I can say this now because she has since had it made public, but they said, yes. I said, well, why don't you want it to know? Because by that point, someone from Cosby's team had leaked, or someone in the prosecution had leaked to a local, to ABC News, that Cosby had said that the relationship was consensual, that the account she gave of that night and the account he gave up that night about the night this happened were completely matched up, except that he said it was consensual and she said it wasn't. And so I said to her, you know, if people know this, then they could say, you know, how can this be consensual? Because I was kind of amazed at the backlash as soon as I started reporting on this story from the other media, from against me, against her. Like, nobody wanted to hear this. And Andrea's attorney said, there's no point in doing that because Cosby's people will just find some guy she dated in high school to say she's not really gay. And she was exactly right. Those were exactly the type of tactics they were using, except it was worse. They were actually making up lies about her and leaking it to the media, and the media was running with it. So I totally understood. And it wasn't until a decade later, after the case popped up again and there was a new court filing that Andrea's attorneys put in, that they finally revealed that fact that she was gay. And at that point, I was just still so surprised they did it. Even though it was in a public court filing, even though I knew that it was okay to reveal it then if they put it in there, I still was called the lawyer to make sure it was okay to say it, because it had been so closely held, such a closely held secret for a decade, and I just wanted to make sure it was okay for me to use it. I mean, that's just the way I approach sensitive subjects in my stories.
Right. Now, Andrea hired Dolores Trumiani and Bibi Kivitz, former prosecutors and law partners in Devon, right outside of Philadelphia. What was their experience that they brought to this case?
Oh, they were both seasoned prosecutors. They had been sex crimes prosecutors. Dolores had been a homicide prosecutor. She had prosecuted the most notorious band of criminals in this area, the Johnston brothers that became the subject of the Sean Penn movie At Close Range. I mean, they're both very fearless, tough prosecutors, and they just were not afraid to take this case on from the beginning. I mean, they just believed Andrea as soon as she came to them, and they had no problem. In fact, Dolores has said that she always felt that she could have gotten a conviction on this case even in 2005 with the evidence that was there.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the Associated Press's first story, the initial media response. Tell us what you read and your reaction to that coverage or take on it.
I mean, sure. I had kept all of my notes and everything from 2005, even after this Andrea Sutter lawsuit, because I packed it up in a box, in a waterproof box, and put it in my basement in case this bubbled up again, in case, you know, some new accuser came forward. So I was looking through all of those old stories, and I knew the other media, the coverage had been bad, but and, you know, very anti-Andrea, but I hadn't realized how bad till I started doing the research for this book last summer. So, I found that the first story the AP did led with, you know, Cosby's lawyer calling these charges bizarre and preposterous. And the lead on my first story that I wrote about the scandal breaking was just that, you know, very, very neutral, you know, Bill Cosby has been accused of, you know, drugging and sexually assaulting a former Temple employee at his Cheltenham mansion, police say. You know, it was very, you know, down the middle. And then, of course, I had his lawyer's response in there. But they basically led with Cosby, you know, just saying that this is bizarre and preposterous. And, you know, their favoritism toward him continued well up into when this scandal rebroke in 2014, because there was an interview where they had interviewed him about, and asked him questions about this, and they didn't release the video of, and he was trying to get them to not release it, and they held on to it for 2 weeks. And he was like, call so-and-so in L.A. and talk to them. And then they finally released the video 2 weeks later. Now, subsequent to that, they also went to court to try to get the deposition unsealed. And they have certainly painted themselves as the savior in this case. And they did, you know, getting those documents partially unsealed was key. But they were a long time coming to that point of view.
You write about Bruce L. Castor, Jr., the Montgomery County District Attorney. And his prosecution of this, or tell us about Bruce Castor and the press release that he issues and what he has to say.
Sure. You know, it's another thing I was surprised about, because I'd known Bruce Castor for years. He loved to hold press conferences at a drop of a hat. He loved high-profile cases. He loved being on TV. And I thought, what a natural one for him to come on to. And he wasn't scared of tough cases. I mean, I had seen him get murder convictions where they didn't even have a murder weapon. In one case, all they had was the imprint of a weapon in a holster, and he was able to get a murder conviction. His office had prosecuted a state trooper who was sexually assaulting teenagers and women for decades, or for years, in the Philadelphia suburbs, and all of them, you know, did not report to the police immediately. They, like Andrea, it was delayed reporting. It's the norm in these cases. It's not the norm is not for sexual assault victims to go to the police right away. In fact, the majority of them never go to police. So I knew that he had handled cases like this, and he understood that. But from the get-go, it just seemed to me like he wanted nothing to do with this case. He didn't. It was 4 days before he even issued a press release, that he didn't have a press conference. And in that press release, which was just 4 short paragraphs, and it was released to just the reporters who worked out of the courthouse in Norristown, Pennsylvania, where his office was. It wasn't released to all of the media. He released it to them first, and then the rest of the media the next day. And it almost like sounded like he was saying he might charge Andrea with a crime. So it was really shocking. Yeah. And then after they interviewed Cosby, he did hold a press conference. And the comments he made, were very important, because the way they were interpreted by at least one woman was that, you know, he had no intention of prosecuting this case. California Attorney Tamara Green heard excerpts of it in California, and she listened to it, and she's like, that's, you know, I'm listening to what he's saying, and he's basically describing the case as weak, which is DA speak for I'm not going to be filing charges. So she decided to come forward with her own story of Cosby trying to do the same thing to her, or doing the same thing to her, 30 years prior. Because she said, I could tell they didn't believe this woman, and I realize having it done to me doesn't prove he did it to her, but they need to know that, you know, he has done this to other women.
Tell us more, as you write in the book, about Tamara Green and why she is just the perfect person to come forward second and have her story public.
Sure. She immediately, you know, she contacted me, and she had contacted law enforcement to tell her story and Andrea's attorneys, and then she reached out to me to give me the first interview, and she wanted her name to be used. She wanted her face to be used. Because she said, no one's going to believe me if I'm an anonymous source. And she's like, I'm a wife, I'm a mother, I'm a lawyer, you know, so hopefully, you know, people will believe me because I'm basically a respectable person. And so she told me her story, and I confirmed it with that she had told other people shortly after it happened. I spoke with them, and she told me, you know, some other things that had happened to her, like she'd had a DUI and all that. But it wasn't relevant to what we were talking about for the story, so it wasn't in there. And I went to Cosby's people for reaction, and they, of course, as I later found out, their attorneys were sending letters threatening to sue us, but my paper refused to back down, as did I. And so she did it, and it was just kind of exploded. And 2 days later, that morning when it ran, my phone was ringing by the time I came in. It was Today's Show producer trying to reach her to see if they could get her on. And And I reached out to Tamar later, and she said it was fine to give him her information, and she went on and was interviewed by Matt Lauer, which is really interesting considering what happened so many years later, right? And it was an awful interview. I mean, he couldn't hide his skepticism. He couldn't hide his arrogance. You know, it was very clear. You know, it was like a very pro-Cosby interview. And, you know, I experienced the same thing when I went on Dan Abrams' show on MSNBC that night. It was very clear how skeptical he was of me. I mean, I was really shocked by the way the media reacted to this story. So, yes, if you put her on the show, but then the coverage quickly died down because Cosby's people were able to control the media. And the AP, again, waited a day and a half to do a story on Tamara and then led with this, some of the dirt Cosby's people had dug up on her in their story.
Tell our audience who Marty Singer is and the kinds of things that he was saying to you.
Sure. Marty Singer is a celebrity attorney. He's represented some of the most, you know, powerful celebrities in Hollywood. Usually when they end up in trouble or whatever, they go to him. And what he tries to do, although I did not know this at the time, he later did an interview with the New York Times where he said basically his strategy is to kill stories before they ever run. He doesn't have to sue and doesn't like to sue because defamation cases are hard to win and you don't win a lot of money. So what he does is he tries to make them never run, and he's very good at it. He does it by, you know, threatening to sue, basically. I mean, even my editor at the time said the letters that were sent to them were some of the most strongly worded he had ever seen. And if you Google around, you'll see some of the other ones he sent, because once this rebroke in 2014, some of the news agencies just started printing them. And then the LA Times did a story, I think, after that, where they printed excerpts of one he sent to them about another similar story they were working on. So I've never in my life experienced anything like it. It was very intimidating. He was very intimidating, and there was just no, like, I'd done a lot of tough stories. I'd been covering cops in Philly, for God's sake. I'd been covering, you know, police corruption in the Pennsylvania State Police. I'd been threatened before. I'd been, I'd had it happen all the time. I was at a press conference with the Pennsylvania State Police Commissioner and the governor, and I asked the state police commissioner a question, and he almost lunged toward me, and the governor had to hold him back. So I can handle it. But this was like nothing I had ever experienced. And then on top of it all, I had the media piling on top of me too. So, but it just, you know, I trusted my reporting, and I wasn't going to back down. If they sued, they sued, but they had no grounds for it. And little did I know, that's not even their strategy. You know, like I said, I didn't find out till a few years later when I saw the New York Times story that his strategy is just to kill these stories, not to actually sue.
You talked about also the threats or offers of future stories. Tell us a little bit about what you found out and how things work in the media that you were surprised about in terms of trading up or offers of future stories. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was my first interaction really with the national media, and I was being asked to be on a lot of TV shows, like the night shows, like Greta Van Susteren had her show then, and of course Dan Abrams. And the bookers were telling me that they were getting a lot of flack from Cosby's people for having me on these shows. And that's where I first learned the phrase trading up, where basically you back off of one story in order to get a better one. And in fact, soon I wasn't being asked to be on those shows anymore. And like ABC, which never covered the allegations at the time, except for the one story they did saying, you know, Cosby says this was consensual, which was a pro-Cosby story. Sure enough, a couple months later, after Castor, the DA had decided not to charge Cosby, they got an exclusive interview with him, and they were allowed access into one of his town halls. And these town halls he was holding across the country within inner cities and kind of lecturing black people about how to behave. And the media wasn't just allowed to go to it. You had to be invited into it. And in fact, when I first started covering the story, his spokesman told me, oh, we've got to get you into one of these town halls. Well, that offer quickly went away after my stories, you know, became more aggressive. But yeah, so that's how I learned that phrase. And it was really disillusioning, to say the least. I mean, I'd never experienced that in local journalism, but I also worked for a newspaper that wasn't afraid of anybody. So that was a big plus.
As you write,
far as trading up went, and then I found out, I'm sorry, and then Beth Ferrier, another accuser, had come forward to the National Enquirer and had told them her story, and they'd had her take a lie detector test. She passed. And then they took it to Cosby, and Cosby, they agreed to kill that story in exchange for Cosby giving them an exclusive interview, which he did. So that is a very classic case of trading up, backing off of one story in order to get another better one.
Incredible. You write that a steady stream of accusers gave statements to Andrea's attorneys, who then turned their info over to detectives. You didn't know what each accuser had said. That knowledge came later. And you were receiving many tips and emails and letters, following up on each as much as you could. And then suddenly, February 17, 2005, what happened? 4 weeks after this case has been opened, what happens?
It was a Thursday, 5:45 p.m. I get a press release, and it's from Bruce Gaster. And it was, you know, as he later testified about this, it was very unusual, not only for him to write his own press release, but for him not to even hold a press conference to announce his decision. But in this press release, he announced he was not going to be filing charges against Cosby, and he listed why. Even though, I found out a decade later that his detectives were still in the middle of their investigation, the Cheltenham Police Commission Chief, none of them knew he was going to do this. They were working hand in hand with Castor's detectives on this case, and even Castor's own detectives, none of them knew he was going to decide not to prosecute. So they were blindsided by it, and Andrea's attorneys were blindsided by it too, because they had bothered to let them know. They found out when a local TV reporter shows up at their office shortly before 6 p.m. with it, and Castor later said that he had sent them the press release, but they're supposed to call. You're not supposed to just do something like that. And it was very traumatic for Andrea, because she was out with her sister and they couldn't reach her. And, the media had gathered outside her home again. They had been almost – there were days where – there's some days her parents couldn't even go to work because there was so much media outside their home. Because another thing that had happened that had violated the normal rules of these sexual assault cases is her name had been leaked into the media, and the media was using her name and image. And that was not the norm, and that happened in a very carefully constructed way. So she had to sneak into her own home later that night after finding this out. So she was just – and there was in that press release Castor wrote, there was, a nasty statement about Andrea. There was much in here that could be used to show both sides in a bad light. It's who does that to as I said, Bebe and Dolores are former sex crimes prosecutors, former prosecutors. They had never seen anything like it. They had never seen a DA disparage a victim that way. And the ironic part is, Andrea did not have any skeletons in her closet. They, as I write about in the book, that's often the tactic that defense attorneys use, and is to disparage the victim. They find some traffic ticket she got or something they did wrong to show she's not credible, something that has nothing to do with the sexual assault case. And they use that against them, and rape shield laws have prevented them from doing that in court. So now they just take it to the media. And what they had leaked was that Andrea had gone to Cosby and tried to get – Andrea and her mother had gone to Cosby before – they went to police and tried to get money out of him, which was not true. That there was a phone call that Andrea's mom recorded that they called a classic shakedown, which was the mom trying to get money out of Cosby. Not true. Turns out that phone call actually is him offering this educational trust and them not taking him up on it. But the media just ran with it. Castor kept calling this phone call an illegal wiretap, even though he'd had his first assistant, DA, research the issue, and that phone call that Andrea's mom recorded was legal, and in fact it was used as evidence in both trials. So that's what he's talking about, much that could be made. Oh, and the fact that she made supposedly inconsistent statements. She had dates mixed up and so forth, but she was drugged and her memory was foggy, and that is also that happens with sexual assault victims. Their memory sometimes comes back in pieces. It's not linear. It's because of the trauma and because of the drugs. And so he made a lot about her inconsistent statements. She was always consistent about what she said happened that night. She was just fuzzy on some of the timing and the details because of being drugged and because of the trauma.
You write about November 8th, 2006, and the civil lawsuit. Tell us. This is one of the most, I guess, disturbing parts of this book. How did Cosby conduct himself at that deposition?
Oh, it was bad. Dolores ended up later testifying on it. He was, you know, he was rude. He was, stormed out a couple of times. They had to have the judge intercede. That's why it ended up being done over 4 days, over a 6-month period. And the judge had to, you know, force them to answer certain questions. Andrea, when she was being questioned, they were hostile to her. It was, and the contents of the deposition, when you read it, are just, it's just creepy. I mean, I saw at the second trial when some of the excerpts were being read, there were two African-American gentlemen who were alternate jurors sitting where I could see them, and they're watching the words being read on the screen, and their look on their faces is like, what the hell? Like, it is just, it reads like soft porn, some of it. It's his description of what he said happened with him and Andrea, and it is just disgusting, you know? So, his behavior. But he's a man who's used to getting his way. Nothing had ever gotten this far with him, because I think that he was able to resolve these cases with the educational trust that he offered Andrea. There was another woman who came forward in 2000 in New York City and said he had tried something similar with her. And then the next thing you know, she's never spoken. And in the deposition, he talks about that case. I put a lot of it in the book. And this last conversation they had, and, you know, it was after that, you know, didn't hear from her again. So my guess is she got some kind of educational trust. But what was interesting to me, too, is, you know, this drugging thing is part of the pattern. And in the deposition, he says she asked him, what did you give me? And that was eye-opening to me, because I don't think anyone else caught that, because there had never been an allegation that he had drugged her as well, that in the reports in the local papers when this happened.
Interesting. Let's use this, Nicole, as an opportunity just to stop for a second to talk about the sponsor, which is Best Fiends. America has fallen in love with Best Fiends, the 5-star rated mobile puzzle game. Discover the world of Minutia and its cute, courageous inhabitants in this fiendishly fun, free-to-download puzzle adventure. I'm on level 50 right now, and right from the very beginning, it's getting more difficult. But I've got a lot of good guys to try to fight the slugs in my corner. Thousands of hours of gameplay, easy to learn, difficult to master. Thousands of levels to challenge. Challenge your brain with fiendish puzzles that require strategy to succeed. Best Friends is the game to play. 5-star rated on the Apple App Store and Google Play. Over 90 million downloads globally. Play offline anywhere, perfect when you want to squeeze in another level on the go. Immediately when I started this game, being a novice, I was very impressed with the visual style of Best Fiends. It's got a really cool story, but the challenges and the solving puzzles have kept me interested. Like I say, I'm a novice, so you don't have to be a gamer to enjoy playing. I'm just really into it, and enjoyed it right from the very beginning. It keeps you interested. Right now, don't miss out on the must-play game of the year. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends. Play today. Now, Nicole, we were talking about what happens next after her civil lawsuit. You talked about the Jane Does coming forward, and you spoke to Barbara Bowman, and there was a staff reduction at Daily News, and so now you are working for People Magazine, freelancing for them. Tell us what happens next and your conversation with Barbara Bowman and what you learn.
Sure. People Magazine had come to me to freelance about the Cosby, you know, because of my coverage of the Cosby case. They were actually pursuing us, one of the few print organizations that was actually pursuing it back then, although nothing ultimately ran. So I'd been freelancing for them, and yeah, I took a voluntary buyout at the Daily News to just freelance, and then I got put on staff at People. And then Andrea settled her lawsuit. So when that happened, I went to the editors, and I was like, can we run that story now? We'd been talking to the accusers for like a year and a half, and, you know, no story had run yet. And so they were very afraid of being sued as well. So I didn't actually interview Barbara Bowman, but another one of our staffers did, because we were broken up by geography then, and Barbara lived in Arizona. So someone out in the Midwest interviewed her. But anyway, yeah, she talked about being a teenager, and she was Jane Doe number 7, and she talked about being a teenager and Cosby drugging her and sexually assaulting her and so on. It was a horrifying story, and she had only told her story at that point. The only other news organization was Philly Mag. I had interviewed another Jane Doe in 2005, Beth Farrier. She was Jane Doe number 5, and she's the one who had given her, you know, interview to the National Enquirer that they killed and didn't tell her in order to get Cosby's interview. So we included her and Beth and Tamara in the story we did. And finally, because they figured, you know, since the lawsuit was settled, as I said to them, if these women are brave enough to have their photos and names used, shouldn't we be brave enough to publish their story? So we did run it, but they made a decision, you know, not to put it on the cover or not to put it in the weekly press release that listed exclusives, and just a very low-key media strategy. And, you know, people was always very secretive about this, so I don't know exactly what was going on, but I do get the sense that I'm sure they were getting the same type of threats to being sued by Marty Singer. So there was no reaction once it ran. And, you know, honestly, there wasn't anything new in it. Like I said, Barbara Bowman had already told her story to Philly Mag. Beth Ferry and Tamara Green had spoken to me in 2005. But still, it was out there, you know, and it was in a national publication, but there was nothing. There was no reaction whatsoever. And that's it.
You know, right.
I just thought, that's it. It's over.
Yeah, and you put your notes away. You say you put them up, bundle them up, and put them in the basement.
Yep, I had all, you know, hundreds and maybe thousands of pages of court documents and notes and interviews, but I just couldn't throw them away. I just thought, you know, let me just keep these just in case. There might be, you know, this story's over, Andrea can't talk, that's over, but maybe some other women might come forward and someday. So, yeah, I just put it all in my basement in a waterproof box and kind of, you know, forgot about it for the next 8 years.
You fast forward to October 2014, and you describe Cosby in a career resurgence. A biography has been written where they don't mention the civil suit whatsoever. And then came Hannibal Buress, a comedian, not well-known comedian. Tell us how this happens and what he says and what this sets off, the firestorm it sets off.
Yeah, again, it's you know, researching the book last summer, I knew all that was happening at the time, but I really didn't realize how completely random it was for that Philly Mag reporter to be at Hannibal Buress' show that night. His name is Dan McQuaid, and he, just at the last minute, his friend said, "I have a ticket to go see Hannibal Buress. Do you want to go?" Literally last minute. So he decided to go, and he went, and he's sitting there kind of fiddling with his iPhone, and all of a sudden he hears the name, Buress say the name Bill Cosby. So his ears perk up, and he thought, okay, Bill Cosby, we're in Philly, this might be a little item for me. So he picks up his iPhone and starts filming it. And it was this routine that apparently Buress had been doing on and off for months, for about 6 months, where he's talking about Bill Cosby lecturing black people about how to behave. But, you know, meanwhile, he's a rapist, you know, so stop lecturing me. And he does this whole thing about that. And he says, if you don't believe me, Google Bill Cosby rapist and you'll see it. So the next day, it was a Friday around 4 p.m., Dan does a story, and they put it up on the video up on the website. And over the weekend, then a BuzzFeed reporter sees it on Facebook, and she thinks, okay, on Monday, she's like, okay, they didn't reach out for comment. I'll reach out to both sides for comment and do an aggregated story. So she does that. And then Gawker, which had just written about the scandal in February with absolutely no reaction, is interested in it. So they do an aggregated piece. And then the Daily Mail, which – as you know, probably picks up stories from everywhere, does a piece. And it just goes crazy on Twitter. And that, you know, to me, that was the biggest difference between 2005 and 2014 was social media. Because in 2005, Cosby could control the media, except for me, but there was no social media. Like, Facebook was still just for college students. There was no Twitter, no Snapchat. News agencies didn't really have good websites, so nothing could go viral. But in 2014, of course, there was Twitter, and that's where it really went crazy. And in addition, a bunch of online news organizations had sprung up, and they just weren't afraid of Cosby at all, and they just started writing stories. And then Barbara Bowman came forward again into the Daily Mail, and she's basically like, I tried to tell this story 10 years ago, and nobody would listen. But she goes the rounds, and she's on CNN, and she writes an op-ed for the Washington Post, and then the first new accuser comes forward in November 2014, and Joan Tarsius. And she's, at this point, you know, I'm just watching it going, this is deja vu all over again. I reported all of this in 2005 and nobody cared. I mean, I had like 30 or some stories from back then. So we were just watching it to see what would happen. And then when Joan Tarsius came forward and when Cosby started canceling appearances, you know, we kind of jumped back in again. And, you know, it was just astonishing to watch unfold.
Not only you talk about Joan Tarsius coming forward and her experience in the 70s with Bill Cosby, but also, very interesting, a black woman named Jewel Allison that was a model. Why was she hesitant to come forward? What was the issue that she was wrestling with?
It's the same issue that Beverly Johnson, the model, that she was the first African-American woman on the cover of Vogue, and he drugged her in attempt, you know, but she was able to escape, that they both struggled with. Beverly ended up writing an essay for Vanity Fair about it because of the bringing, you know, they didn't want to bring down a black man. They thought African-American men have enough problems. He's an icon in our community. You know, I don't, you know, is it right of me to do this? And in the end, they both decided, yes, we have to come forward, because the other women who had come forward were being eviscerated by Cosby's people. And although the media was on board this time, in 2005, the media was jumping on board to disparage these women as well, but that had changed in 2014, and all of a sudden the media was on board. But they figured, you know, he's not your typical African-American defendant. He's wealthy, powerful, privileged, you know, everything that most African-American defendants are. So they really felt like they needed to tell their experience to support these other women who had come forward who weren't being believed.
So what happens next?
So it continues, you know, to unfold. The AP, the Associated Press, decides to file a motion to try to get some of the court documents unsealed from the 2005 case. Because they figured, you know, Cosby was having pretty much every document sealed back then. It was requesting that, and the judge was agreeing. So there were motions that had excerpts from various depositions in those filings that had all been sealed. So it took until almost July before, because Cosby's people were fighting it, for the judge to eventually rule that, yes, these documents can be unsealed. And his rationale was very interesting because, you know, Cosby had started his whole town hall crusade around the country with this pound, what was now known as the pound cake speech in D.C. in May of 2004, in which, again, he was chastising black people, making fun of their crazy names and for having their pants hanging around their ankles and all of this. So anyway, and then it had gone on even after being accused by Andrea to write a book with Alvin Poussant about, you know, lecturing black people how to behave, basically. It was called the Blame the Poor Tour. That's what one critic called his town halls in 2004 and 2005. So the judge ruled, basically, that Cosby had normally these documents would not be public because you have the right to privacy. But he ruled that Cosby had basically narrowed his right to privacy by lecturing and publicly scolding people about these ethical and moral issues. And so, therefore, he had narrowed his own right to privacy. So, therefore, these documents could be unsealed.
Let's talk about his eventual arrest. You say you were caught by surprise. Tell us about that.
Sure. You know, it was explosive when those excerpts got released. And then through this legal loophole, the New York Times got the whole deposition and wrote a really good story about it. And in it, you know, Cosby is admitting to giving quaaludes to women he wanted to have sex with. I mean, it was really shocking to people, and it forced some of his supporters to walk back their support. Because you have to remember back then, as Burris said, he had a Teflon image. He was Mr. Family Man. He'd written best-selling books about being a dad and about his childhood. You know, he just, no whisper of any using any drugs. I mean, he was about as clean cut as you could get, except for, you know, the one affair he admitted to having with, you know, Autumn Jackson's mother. So that whole other scandal where he got her arrested for extortion and blackmail. So anyway, it was really shocking for him to be admitting that. And he said he had 7 prescriptions for quaaludes. This is all in the deposition. So all of this causes the DA and the new DA in Montgomery County, it's a different DA who was Bruce Castor's first assistant back then, to reopen the case. And then Philly Inquirer had a story about that, like, that September. And, yeah, I was surprised. Like, it was – I thought maybe there would be other cases that would come up, but I certainly did not expect Andrea's case to come back. I thought the statute of limitations would have passed a long time ago, but it turned out that with what she had said happened to her, which was digital penetration, which is it's a crime called aggravated indecent assault, and the statute of limitations on that is 12 years, which was going to be up the following January. Like, there was a very short window of time for them to act on this. So, you know, they actually, the first assistant, Kevin Steele, you know, his boss told him, let's look into reopening this, and he went to Andrea's attorneys and was like, are you she going to cooperate if we reopen this? And Dolores admits she was shocked too. Like, she really didn't see that one coming either. And she had long talks with Andrea about it, because Andrea had been treated so terribly by Castor. They were, you know, that was, would she even be willing to put herself through that again? But Andrea agreed because it was a different DA. And she really had felt, as it came out later in her testimony, that, you know, this bad, that no justice had been had. Yes, she'd gotten a settlement of the lawsuit, but that's not justice. That's a totally different thing. And but Castor, in the meantime, had decided to run for office to get his old job back. He had decided to run for DA. So he was up against Steele that fall, and the Cosby case came up in the ads. And but Kevin Steele ended up winning. And actually, but what happened was that Bruce Castor made more disparaging comments about Andrea. He put on his public Facebook page about her inconsistent statements and a lot of things, to the point where Andrea's attorney sent him a letter saying, basically, publicly apologize or, you know, retract those statements or we will sue you for defamation. And he refused to do it and, in fact, made more comments to the Philadelphia Inquirer that were disparaging about her. So the week before the election, Andrea filed a defamation lawsuit against him. And then Kevin Steele won, and then, you know, Cosby was arrested on December 30th.
Yes. Take us to the trial itself and Andrea's testimony and also her mother, Gianna's testimony. Tell us a little bit about, as you write in the book, a little bit about the beginning of this trial and the testimony of Andrea and Gianna.
Okay. At this point, you know, 64 women, by my count, had come forward to say Cosby had done or attempted to do similar things to them as to what he did to Andrea. But the judge only allowed one of them to testify at this first trial. The prosecution had asked for 13 to be able to testify. They're called so-called prior bad act witnesses. None of them had gone to police or there were no convictions, but they're used to show a pattern of behavior. And it's up to a judge whether it's allowed in, and they have to weigh its probative value versus its prejudicial value, because it can be very prejudicial to a defendant. And in the end, the judge, without explaining why, allowed one to testify. And her story was pretty horrifying. And so Andrea and Gianna told theirs, though. And, you know, it was the first time you heard from her mouth. Like, it was the first time we saw Andrea speak about it. She had never spoken publicly. Even at the preliminary hearing, they just read her statements. A detective did. They did not have her testimony. So it was very powerful to hear her speak for the first time. And, you know, she's kind of a soft voice, but it's firm. She's a very calm, gentle person. That's kind of the impression you get from her, very polite. I mean, she called Cosby Mr. Cosby, even in her statements when she's talking about him. But she got very, and she's not an emotional person, at least outwardly, but she got very emotional as she started talking about the night this happened and telling what happened to her, and she seemed to fight off tears. And her mother, you know, Gianna, is just this fierce mama bear. You know, she's the mom we all want to have because she just had her daughter's back. And some of these, you know, some of the women were not that fortunate when they tried to tell their parents about what happened to them or their mom. The mom did not want to hear it or the mom did not want to believe it. So, you know, she told her story and they played the tape. And, you know, she said that Cosby, in the first conversation she had with him, which was like 2.5 hours long, Cosby apologized to her and to Andrea, and that he admitted he was a sick person. And what was kind of gross is he also said to Andrea, was on the phone, he goes, tell her you had an orgasm. Tell your mom you had an orgasm. And he kept calling Andrea's mom, mom. And it was just so gross, you know, and Andrea ends up hanging up the phone. He's trying to tell her, trying to convince her mom this was consensual. But her mom also was going, why didn't you call 911? How did you know she was going to wake up? And this becomes a theme, an undercurrent theme in my book, because that point it's important to raise. It is very dangerous to drug someone without their knowledge or consent. You don't know what they have in their system. You don't know if they could be allergic to it. You don't know. And to drug someone without their consent is very dangerous. And, you know, who knows what could have happened if some you know, or also some of these women drove afterward, like Tamara Green and Becky Cooper, another Jane Doe, and they're not sure how they were able to even drive after taking whatever drug it was that he slipped into their drinks that he gave them. So, yeah, that becomes an undercurrent here, too. You know, why didn't you call now? How did you know they were going to wake up? You know, it's very, like I keep saying it, but it is an important point to make. It's very dangerous to do this to someone. I didn't find out I was allergic to Demerol until I got surgery for a dog bite many years ago. And when they, you know, put Demerol in me when I was coming out of the surgery, I broke out in hives all over my body, and they had to quickly do an antidote or I would have died. I mean, how do you know someone wouldn't have that reaction to whatever it is he's putting into their drinks? So, yeah, that's why Gianna was so worried, too, and that's why she really wanted to know what he had given her. And he had told her he was going to – he said he was going upstairs to look at his prescription bottles, and he'd come down and tell her what it was. Then he comes back down and says, oh, I can't read it. I will write it down on a piece of paper, and I will send it to you. So in the second phone call that Andrea – that Gianna taped, she's trying to get out of him. What did you give my daughter? And she's like, did you send that to me? Are you going to send it to me? And he's like, no. And he tries to switch the subject. Like, let's talk. You said Andrea wants to go back to school. Maybe let's talk about some kind of educational trust. I'm willing to pay for that if she gets certain grades. And Gianna just ignores it. She just keeps pressing him. What did you give my daughter? What did you give my daughter? And he won't answer it. And then after they get off the phone, and next thing you know, like Marty Singer's calling, and he's trying to get them to agree to come to Miami, or to see him, you know, to meet with him in Miami so they can discuss this educational trust. And, of course, you know, they don't agree to that. But then Marty Singer calls to set it up, and then someone from his agent from William Morris calls to talk about it. And, you know, of course, by this time, Andrea was already represented by Dolores and Bebe, and no way in hell were they going to let her go to Miami. They thought, and Dolores testified to this many years later, that they thought that he was setting her up just like with Autumn Jackson, where she had come to New York and all of a sudden she's arrested for bribery and extortion. They thought anyway that whole trip was just to set her up for her to be arrested like Autumn Jackson was.
You have a dramatic scene in here where Prosecutor Fedden talks about the drugging of a woman and Cosby's behavior at court, at trial. Tell us what he was doing that prompted her to fly and into a rage in her.
Yeah, delivery. It was her. It was this. Well, throughout the first trial, he was coming in and out doing hey, 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 Fat Albert to the crowds. And I was sitting in the hall once when he did this whole comic routine because one of the sheriffs was telling people not to pull out their cell phones when he was going by because they didn't want them snapping pictures of him. And I guess someone, he looked like someone was, so he went, hey! And Cosby was being walked with Andrew Wyatt, his spokesperson, and he cowers down, does this whole dramatic thing, you know, like he's, oh my God, I won't do anything. So he was clowning around a lot, and he was laughing or smiling during testimony. And then in the closing arguments of the second trial, Kristen was, you know, giving her very emotional, passionate closing argument, and she looks over and she sees Cosby, which she thinks he's laughing, and she flies across the room and she goes, sexual assault isn't funny. Drugging and sexually assaulting a woman without her consent isn't funny. And she just kind of blasts him, and it was a very powerful moment.
You talk about, as opposed to the first trial, the second trial had the other accusers to testify. Tell us about that testimony in the second trial.
Sure. So there was a mistrial after 52 hours of deliberations for the first trial in June of 2017. And then in between, Cosby has cycled through a lot of lawyers. So the second trial was supposed to be in November, but it got pushed back to the next April because Cosby switched attorneys again. I mean, he's had like 24, 25 attorneys throughout this. So in the meantime, the Me Too movement had sprung up. Not that it has anything to do with the case, but it did. And then this time the prosecution asked for 19 women to be able to testify. And the judge, and there had been a ruling on one a certain court case that clearly made the judge feel more comfortable allowing 5 women to testify this time. So that's what happened, is 5 other accusers were allowed to testify. And the prosecution used a different strategy the second time. They put the sexual assault expert on first because they had, you know, talked to the jurors from the first trial. They had looked at their own strategies, and they knew, you know, obviously if they got a mistrial, they needed to do it better the second time, and they really did. So because in the first trial, they put their sexual assault expert on much later in the trial, and well, after the other women had testified, after Andrea had testified, after, you know, everyone had testified. And so it seemed clear that those jurors struggled with, they didn't understand certain rape victims' behaviors. So they put the sexual assault expert on first, and it was a different one this time. And basically, she went through and debunked rape myth after rape myth. She was an excellent witness. She's actually been hired by the prosecution in the Harvey Weinstein case now, too, for that trial. And she just, you know, said it is the norm for, you know, rape victims to delay reporting, it's the norm for them not to go to police, that it is the most underreported violent crime, that 85% of sexual assaults are committed by someone the victim knows, only 15% are strangers, that in those cases it's the norm for them to sometimes keep in touch with them. They're trying to make sense of them. It's the norm to not fight back. Just all of this victim behavior that might not make sense to a person who didn't know someone who'd been sexually assaulted, that they have inconsistencies in their stories because memory comes back to them in patches. It's not a linear thing that they at first sometimes can't even tell it literally. Linearly, and especially when there's drugs involved. So all of these things that were being used to criticize Andrea in the first trial, she was explaining from the beginning and at the very beginning of the trial. And then it was, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the 5 women, and then Andrea. And also, you know, Cosby had 7 attorneys at this second trial, and they adopted this they were even more aggressive than Brian McMonagle was in the first one. And, like, Mesereau, who had gotten Michael Jackson successfully acquitted of molestation charges, was the attorney. And he was very aggressive with all of the women. In fact, at one point, Janice Baker Kinney is being questioned by him, and she looks at him and she goes, "Are you rolling your eyes at me?" And he says, "Yes, I am." I mean, and Judith Reagan, who was there to support model Janice Dickinson's story about why she didn't include the rape in her 2002 memoir, she was so furious by the time she got off the stand about the way they treated her that her rep called me afterward, and I ended up writing, doing a separate interview and story with her for the Daily Beast because she just was just so like mad about the disrespectful, condescending tone they'd used. And then one of the other women, Shaylon, who was just 15 when she met Cosby and 17 when this happened, she's sobbing throughout her entire testimony, and she, at the end, she looks over at Cosby and goes, and she screams, "You remember, don't you, Mr. Cosby?" And he just smiled. You know, it was very, very powerful testimony. So then Andrea came, and then her mother. And, you know, I interviewed the jury foreperson and one of the jurors for this story, and, you know, I really think that was just a very smart strategy by them. But in the end, you know, you can convict in Pennsylvania in a sexual assault case if you find the victim credible. And they did. They found the victim credible. Cosby put up a number of his own witnesses this time. He didn't put up any in the first trial, one of whom was a woman who said she worked with Andrea at Temple University and had shared a room with her on a basketball trip and about a year before Andrea went to police, and that Andrea said she was going to set up someone high profile. And Andrea testified that she never shared a room when she traveled with women's basketball team, and she didn't remember this conversation. And then I just kept waiting for the smoking gun because the defense had made a big deal, Andrew Wyatt, about the fact that the judge hadn't allowed this woman, Margaret Jackson, to testify at the first trial. So I figured, and then so he allowed her in at the second. So I was waiting for the smoking gun, right? There must be proof. If they shared a room together, there's got to be hotel records because this is a Temple University. Yeah. So not only did they not have that, the prosecution went back and found records, and they found records for her travel with a team in February 2003, but not in February 2004 when she said she traveled with them. So the jurors, when they were discussing all this while they were deliberating, some of them believed Margot, some didn't. So that's why one of the things they asked to be read back to them was her testimony. And once they heard her testimony again, they all agreed that they found her not credible. They sort of put a check mark back by her, she's not credible. And while they found Andrea credible. And they said she wouldn't look at them. That Margot never looked at them either while she was testifying, which is, not good.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about Janice Dickinson, why the details of her assault were not included in her biography was because of the publisher, right? Is that correct?
Exactly, and that's why Judith Reagan was there as a supporting witness. And her ghostwriter, I spoke with as well. He also said the same thing. But she wanted it in the version of it that Judith had to tell her, no, we can't. Our legal won't allow it. Cosby's known as being very litigious, so they took it out and they had it portrayed very differently in the memoir, which is what Janice said. And they said Janice was very upset at the time. Like, she really wanted to include it in the book, and she was really emotional and distraught over the decision not to include it. But that they, and then, of course, she got hammered about that by Mesereau when she was cross-examined.
The details of her civil suit were revealed at the second trial as well, and they were allowed. Why was that?
Yes, it was... For the first time, we found out how much she got in her settlement, and it was $3.38 million, which the prosecution revealed. The defense wanted it in because a key part of their strategy was to say that, Andrea was a con artist, that she just wanted money, and so she made up these allegations and so forth. But, the flaw in that argument, in my view, is that it doesn't make sense to use that strategy all these years later because she got her money in 2006. So if that is why, she made up these allegations, then why is she here and why is she subjecting herself to not one trial but two? The logic in it was kind of flawed, but that was the strategy he had used in the Michael Jackson case that was very successful. So that's why they wanted it in. But it also favored the prosecution because it shows that this was just not, nuisance money. This wasn't $100,000 keep your mouth shut money. This was a lot of money to give to somebody if you say you didn't do anything. And then in the charging, in the affidavit when Cosby was arrested, they also, pointed out that, people don't give this, innocent people don't, a lot of times don't give this amount of money either,
Right.
So it was powerful to learn the amount, and it was a double-edged sword. It could either work for or against the prosecution.
What was your sense of the trial and its outcome when the jury went to deliberation at the end of the trial? What was your sense, not that you could say for certain, but what was your sense on how the case had been prosecuted and how the jury had responded to that information? From everything you saw and heard, what did you think?
I thought, this jury, this was, the first jury was from Allegheny County, which is around Pittsburgh, because Cosby had wanted an out-of-town jury, and it's just a less affluent area, more high school educated and stuff, not to disparage it, and I have family from there, but Cosby agreed not to ask for an out-of-town jury for a second trial in order to get the delay he got, so he could get his new attorneys up to speed, so it was a Montgomery County jury, which is right outside of Philly, and it's the wealthiest county in Pennsylvania. The jury foreperson is vice president of cybersecurity for an international emergency management firm. Another one worked for OSHA. Another one was president of a bank. It was a very sophisticated jury because this is tough stuff. I had never really thought about this before, but no one tells a jury how to deliberate. They're given guidelines, the judge gives them instructions, but no one says you go back in the room, you sit down, you all talk, you take a vote. Once they're in the room, it's up to them about how they do it. So I totally understand why the first jury, it was so contentious. In fact, it was like there was screaming and yelling coming from there. Apparently, one juror punched a wall in the first trial. Another one who had quit smoking took up smoking again. It was a very emotional, contentious jury. And I have a feeling they voted more than once based on some of the interviews I saw. But this one, they were very methodical. And they kind of struck me from the get-go like the Sandusky jury, in the Jerry Sandusky case. I had covered that case, and that jury was very thoughtful and methodical. They had 10 victims and 10 sets of charges to go through, and they took like 12, 14 hours, but they did it, and their decisions made sense. I mean, the only two charges he wasn't convicted of were the ones where the one victim didn't testify. So I got that sense. So I thought, okay, maybe a conviction on one count, but there were three counts. But it was just so hard to tell. It's, you know, again, it's a tough thing to be a juror, and it's a tough thing to convict an 81-year-old man. And, you know, the Cosby's team had done their best to disparage the women who came forward. And it seemed to backfire a little bit because during closing arguments, I actually saw a couple of the jurors wince during Cosby's defense team's closing arguments. I guess I was thinking maybe a conviction on one. I was completely shocked when it was a conviction on all three.
And they didn't deliberate
for long.
But
I thought that's a tribute. No. I mean, it was like 12, 14 hours. They asked to have read back Margot Jackson's testimony, and then they wanted to rehear some of Cosby's deposition testimony. And that was it. Well, the first jury, you know, basically had the whole trial read back to them. And I had seen this jury. They were all taking copious notes, which they're allowed to do during the trial, too. So they – and they're, you know, these were sequestered jurors, too, and they were sequestered much longer than the other jury because this went on for 2.5, almost 3 weeks, while the first trial was over in a week. In fact, the deliberations almost lasted longer than the trial did. So but they were very methodical about the way they went about it, and it showed. And they, you know, they talked through everything, and if they disagreed, you know, they went back in to hear it. It sounded like a really good – it's like the jury pool you wish you get if anything ever happens to you, whether or not they convict you. I mean, they were very thoughtful and very methodical about it. It was not an emotional decision. It was like basically it really revolved, when you boil it down, to the fact that they believed Andrea.
What were the three charges?
They found her credible.
What were the three charges that he was found guilty of?
There were three counts of aggravated indecent assault, one without her consent, one while drugged, one while unconscious.
Now, they have to wait for sentencing. What was the sentencing, and what was the reaction from the media and from the accusers?
Yeah, and again, you know, this case continued to surprise me. I knew Cosby was going to do his best to try to stay out of jail while he was – I knew he was going to appeal his conviction and appeal his sentencing, whatever it was, because that's how he is. He has fought every step of the way on this. And I knew he would make a move to be out on bail while doing all these appeals, and that process couldn't start till after sentencing. But, you know, he was sentenced to jail, to prison. The judge sentenced him to 3 to 10 years in prison, which was a little above the minimum, and he was to go directly to jail. He tried to get a motion to allow him to stay out on bail, but the judge didn't allow it. And apparently when it's over a 2-year sentence, it's the norm not to let someone stay out on bail while they're appealing, and his sentence was 3 to 10 years. So he's eligible for parole at 3 years, but that's the victims have a say in that, first of all, and that's assuming you have to show remorse and really admit responsibility for what you did, and he's still maintaining that this was a consensual relationship, that it was not sexual assault. So I just don't see him making bail or making parole at 3 years. And he's appealing, but these appeals take years as well. And this judge has a reputation for rarely being overturned on appeal. So it's not a slam dunk that he's going to get a new trial or get a new sentencing. I mean, this judge is very careful, and he has a great reputation. And like I said, he rarely gets overturned on appeal. But that's clearly what they're hoping for.
What about the issue of him being designated a sexually violent predator?
Right, that was a piece of this as well, and he was designated one. And the disorder he was diagnosed with is basically liking to have sex with an unconscious person. And this just means he has to do mandatory counseling. If he gets out, he's got to make sure his whereabouts are reported to the Pennsylvania State Police so they can notify the victims. So it has those type of requirements that don't mean a lot when he's incarcerated, but certainly mean a lot if he gets out. Because he has, you know, his face would be on like the Megan's Law website, you know, so people in the area know where he lives. And, you know, he still has that home in Cheltenham right outside Philly. He'd have to ask permission if he wanted to go to another state, like where his wife lives up in Massachusetts. So it's just a lot of red tape for him.
What's Andrea's life look like now since this? Tell us about Andrea.
So she did finish her, go to massage school and become a masseuse. She works a lot with cancer patients for her clients, or people with Parkinson's, or people with diseases. And she, you know, she has a very good life, but as she, you know, her victim impact statement, she inserted it into the record. She did not read it at sentencing, and I don't blame her. I don't know if her reason was, like, she didn't want Cosby to see her bare her soul like that, and I wouldn't blame her. But, you know, we all got copies of it. It was really powerful. It was and sad. I mean, her life has been on hold during this time, and she's not married. She has not, you know, gotten a close relationship. She's close with her family and her dogs. But this, you know, really, really changed who she was. And I hope now, as I write in there, that, you know, now that she got this kind of closure and a verdict and sort of like a we believe you finally from at least a jury, that she can, you know, move on with her life. And she wants to, I think, help other sexual assault survivors in any way she can, and, you know, work on things like that in addition to her job as a masseuse. And she wants to, you know, her life has sort of been on this hold for so many years, and hopefully now it's going to be moving forward again.
Yes, absolutely. Now, just before I let you go, obviously there's the Bill Cosby legacy. How much of that Bill Cosby legacy has been tarnished? What has been taken away? Some of the things that tell us just the state of his legacy, I would say.
Well, I mean, a lot of his, you know, awards have been stripped away. A lot of his honorary degrees have been taken from him. He's, you know, had a lot of that taken from him, but you can't take away all the millions. He's donated millions to Spelman College. He's donated, you know, a lot to a lot of different universities and so forth. You can't take away from him the good he's done, but you have to counteract that and acknowledge and understand what else he was doing during that time period. I mean, it almost became a cover for him that allowed him to continue for so long, because he was this great guy doing such great things. It's what allows, like, the Catholic priests to continue doing what they're doing, or in the Boy Scouts, or Jerry Sandusky, you know, the Penn State defensive coach who founded a charity for at-risk boys and then preyed upon many of them. They were many of his victims. So you just have to put it in the context of his whole life. Just because he did good things doesn't mean he's a good person. And just because he did bad things doesn't mean he's a bad person. You have to make your own decisions about what you think about it. And that's why I encourage people to read the book, because, you know, you only get bits and pieces of these stories in the news. And I thought having it all in one place for people to see it and read it and kind of understand it and kind of you can see the pattern was important for people, because there are still a lot of people who, you know, do not want to believe these women. And none of the women knew each other. I mean, they would have had to I don't know how it could be a conspiracy when they're all telling chillingly similar stories that they told other people along the way, long before they came forward publicly. But they didn't know each other. So I don't know how you explain that. Are all of them lying, and why? I mean, it's not exactly a badge of honor to be known as a rape victim in society. And who wants to be famous for that? The only thing some of the women have used the platform this gave them for is to get statute of limitations laws eliminated or extended in three different states.
Right.
But they still, you know, you almost still get tarred and feathered when you come forward with allegations against this, especially when it's against a powerful, beloved person like Bill Cosby.
Well, it's evidenced through your tenacity on this case, and also always the accusers, Andrea, Tamara, and all the other 13 accusers. I want to applaud you for tenacity on this case and your remarkable book, Chasing Cosby, The Downfall of America's Dad. I want to thank you very much, Nicole Wisenzee-Egan, for this. Again, remarkable book, and I want to applaud you for your tenacity sticking to this and this remarkable book as a result.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
I want to thank you very much, and you have a great evening. Good night.
Okay, thanks. You too. Bye.